Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. In a strange turn of events, John succumbed to the corporatocracy when he sold IPS in November of 1990. It was a lucrative deal for his partners and him, but they sold out mainly because Ashland Oil Company put tremendous pressure on them. John knew from experience that fighting them would be extremely costly in many ways, while selling would make them wealthy. However, it did strike him as ironic that an oil company would become the new owners of his alternative energy company. Part of him felt like a traitor. Sweck demanded very little of his time. Occasionally, he was asked to fly to Boston for meetings or to help prepare a proposal. John was sometimes sent to places like Rio de Janeiro to hobnob with the movers and shakers there. Once, he flew to Guatemala on a private jet. He frequently called project managers to remind them that he was on the payroll and available. Receiving all that money for doing so very little rubbed at his conscience. John knew the business well and wanted to contribute something useful, but it was simply not on the agenda. The image of being a man in the middle haunted John. He wanted to take some action that would justify his existence and that might turn all the negatives of his past into something positive. He continued to work surreptitiously and very irregularly on Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and yet he did not deceive himself into believing that it would ever be published. In 1991, he began guiding small groups of people into the Amazon to spend time with and learn from the Shuars, who were eager to share their knowledge about environmental stewardship and indigenous healing techniques. During the next few years, the demand for these trips increased rapidly and resulted in the formation of a nonprofit organization, Dream Change Coalition. dedicated to changing the way people from industrialized countries see the Earth and our relationship to it, Dream Change developed a following around the world and empowered people to create organizations with similar missions in many countries. Time magazine selected it as one of 13 organizations whose websites best reflect the ideals and goals of Earth Day. Throughout the 1990s, John became increasingly involved in the nonprofit world, helping to create several organizations and serving on the board of directors of others. Many of these grew out of the work of highly dedicated people at Dream Change and involved working with indigenous people in Latin America, the Shuars and the Achuars of the Amazon, the Quechuas of the Andes, the Mayas in Guatemala, or teaching people in the United States and Europe about these cultures. SWEC approved of this philanthropic work. It was consistent with SWEC's own commitment to the United Way. John also wrote more books, always careful to focus on indigenous teachings and to avoid references to his EHM activities. Besides alleviating his boredom, these measures helped him keep in touch with Latin America and the political issues that were dear to him. But try as John might to convince himself that his nonprofit and writing activities provided a balance, that he was making amends for his past activities, he found this increasingly difficult. In his heart, he knew he was shirking his responsibilities to his daughter. Jessica was inheriting a world where millions of children are born saddled with debts they will never be able to repay, and John had to accept responsibility for it. John's books grew in popularity, especially one titled The World Is As You Dream It. Its success led to increasing demands for him to give workshops and lectures. Sometimes, standing in front of an audience in Boston or New York or Milan, John was struck by the irony. If the world is as you dream it, why had he dreamed such a world? How had he managed to play such an active role in manifesting such a nightmare? In 1997, he was commissioned to teach a week-long Omega Institute workshop in the Caribbean at a resort on St. John Island. John arrived late at night. When he awoke the next morning, he walked out onto a tiny balcony and found himself looking out at the very bay where, 17 years earlier, he had made the decision to quit Maine. He collapsed into a chair, overcome with emotion. Throughout the week, he spent much of his free time on that balcony, looking down at Leinster Bay, trying to understand his feelings. John came to realize that although he had quit, he had not taken the next step, and that his decision to remain in the middle was exacting a devastating toll. By the next week, he had concluded that the world around him was not one that he wanted to dream, and that he needed to do exactly what he was instructing his students to do, to change his dreams in a way that reflected what he really wanted in his life. When he returned home, John gave up corporate consulting practice. The president of SWEC, who had hired him, was now retired. A new man had come aboard, one who was younger than him, and was apparently unconcerned about John telling his story. The man had initiated a cost-cutting program and was happy not to have to pay John the exorbitant retainer any longer. John decided to complete the book he had been working on for so long, and just making the decision brought a wonderful sense of relief. John shared his ideas about writing with close friends, mostly people in the non-corporate world who are involved with indigenous cultures and rainforest preservation. To his surprise, they were dismayed. They feared that speaking out would undermine his teaching work and jeopardize the nonprofit organizations he supported. Many of them were helping Amazon tribes protect their lands from oil companies. Coming clean, John was told, could undermine his credibility and might set back the whole movement. Some even threatened to withdraw their support. So once again, he stopped writing. Instead, he focused on taking people deep into the Amazon, showing them a place and a tribe that are mostly untouched by the modern world. In fact, that is where he was on September 11th, 2001. and I'll come back to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now we look at September 11th and its aftermath for John personally. On September 10th, 2001, John was traveling down a river in the Ecuadorian Amazon with Shekaim Chumpi, the co-author of his book, Spirit of the Shuar. They were leading a group of 16 North Americans to the co-author's community deep in the rainforest. The visitors had come to learn about his people and to help them preserve their precious rainforests. Shekaim had fought as a soldier in the recent Ecuador-Peru conflict. Most people in the major oil-consuming nations have never heard about this war, yet it was fought primarily to provide them with oil. Although the border between the two countries was disputed for many years, only recently did a resolution become urgent. The reason for the urgency was that the oil companies needed to know with which country to negotiate in order to win concessions for specific tracts of the oil-rich lands. Borders had to be defined. The Shuars formed Ecuador's first line of defense. They proved themselves to be ferocious fighters, often overcoming superior numbers and better equipped forces. The Shuars did not know anything about the politics behind the war, or that its resolution would open the door to oil companies. They fought because they came from a long tradition of warriors and because they were not about to allow foreign soldiers onto their lands. As they paddled down the river, watching a flock of chattering parrots fly overhead, John asked Shekaim whether the truce was still holding. "Yes," he said, "but I'm afraid I must tell you that we are now preparing to go to war with you." Shekaim went on to explain that, of course, he did not mean John personally or the people in their group. "You are our friends," he assured John. He was, he said, referring to oil companies and to the military forces that would come into his jungle to defend them. "We've seen what they did to the Huarani tribe. They destroyed their forests, polluted the rivers, and killed many people, including children. Today, the Huarani hardly exist as a people anymore. We won't let this happen to us. We won't allow oil companies into our territory any more than we would the Peruvians. We have all sworn to fight to the last man." That night, their group sat around a fire in the center of a beautiful Shuar longhouse built from split bamboo slats placed in the ground and covered with a thatched roof. John told them about his conversation with Shekaim. They all wondered how many other people in the world felt similarly about U.S. oil companies and the U.S. How many, like the Shuars, were terrified that the U.S. would come into their lives and destroy their culture and their lands. How many hated the U.S.? The next morning, John went down to the little office where they kept their two-way radio. John needed to arrange for pilots to fly in and pick them up in a few days. As he was talking with them, he heard a shout. "My God," the man on the other end of the radio exclaimed, "New York is under attack." John turned up the commercial radio that had been playing music in the background. During the next half hour, they received a minute-by-minute account of the events unfolding in the United States. Like everyone else, it was a moment John shall never forget. When he returned to his home in Florida, he knew he had to visit Ground Zero, the former site of the World Trade Center towers, so he arranged to fly to New York. John checked into his uptown hotel in early afternoon. It was a sunny November day, unseasonably balmy. He strolled along Central Park, filled with enthusiasm, then headed for a part of the city where once he had spent a lot of time, the area near Wall Street, now known as Ground Zero. As he approached, his enthusiasm was replaced with a sense of horror. The sights and smells were overwhelming. The incredible destruction, the twisted and melted down skeletons of those once great buildings, the debris, the rancid odor of smoke, charred ruins, and burnt flesh. John had seen it all on TV, but being there was different. John had not been prepared for this, especially not for the people. 2 months had passed, and they still stood around, those who lived or worked nearby, those who had survived. An Egyptian man was loitering outside his small shoe repair shop, shaking his head in disbelief. "Can't get used to it," he muttered. "I lost many customers, many friends. My nephew died up there." He pointed at the blue sky. "I think I saw him jump. I don't know. So many were jumping, holding hands and flapping their arms as though they could fly." It came as a surprise, the way people talked with one another in New York City. And it went beyond language. Their eyes met. Although somber, they exchanged looks of compassion, half smiles that spoke more than a million words. But there was something else, a sense about the place itself. At first, John couldn't figure it out. Then it struck him. The light. Lower Manhattan had been a dark canyon, back in the days when he made the pilgrimage to this part of the town to raise capital for IPS, when John used to plot strategy with his investment bankers over dinner at Windows on the World. You had to go that high, to the top of the World Trade Center, if you wanted to see light. Now, here it was at street level. The canyon had been split wide open, and they who stood on the street beside the ruins were warmed by the sunshine. John couldn't help wondering if the view of the sky, of the light, had helped people open their hearts. He felt guilty just thinking such thoughts. John turned the corner at Trinity Church and headed down Wall Street, back to the old New York, enveloped in shadow. No sky, no light. People hurried along the sidewalk, ignoring one another. A cop screamed at a stalled car. John sat down on the first steps he came to, at number 14. From somewhere, the sounds of giant fans or an air blower rose above the other noises. It seemed to come from the massive stone wall of the New York Stock Exchange building. John watched the people. They hustled up and down the street, leaving their offices, hurrying home, or heading to a restaurant or bar to discuss business. A few walked in tandem and chatted with each other. Most, though, were alone and silent. John tried to make eye contact. It didn't happen. The wail of a car alarm drew his attention down the street. A man rushed out of an office and pointed a key at the car. The alarm went silent. John sat there quietly for a few long moments. After a while, he reached into his pocket and pulled out a neatly folded piece of paper covered with statistics. Then John saw him. The man shuffled along the street, staring down at his feet. He had a scrawny gray beard and wore a grimy overcoat that looked especially out of place on this warm afternoon on Wall Street. John knew he was Afghan. The man glanced at John. Then, after only a second of hesitation, the man started up the steps. He nodded politely and sat down beside John, leaving a yard or two between them. From the way he looked straight ahead, John realized it would be up to him to begin the conversation. And we will return after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you're listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. "Nice afternoon," John said. "Beautiful," said the man with a thick accent. "Times like these, we want sunshine." John responded, "You mean because of the World Trade Center?" The man nodded. "You're from Afghanistan?" The man stared at him. "Is it so obvious?" "I've traveled a lot. Recently, I visited the Himalayas, Kashmir." "Kashmir," The man pulled at his beard. Fighting. Yes, said John. India and Pakistan, Hindus and Muslims. Makes you wonder about religion, doesn't it? The man's eyes met John's. They were deep brown, nearly black. They struck John as wise and sad. He turned back toward the New York Stock Exchange building. With a long, gnarled finger, the man pointed at the building. Or maybe, John agreed, it's about economics, not religion. Are you a soldier? Asked the man. John couldn't help but chuckle. No, an economic consultant. John handed him the paper with the statistics. These were my weapons. The man reached over and took them. Numbers. World statistics, said John. The man studied the list, then gave a little laugh. I can't read. He handed it back to John. John said, the numbers tell us that 24,000 people die every day from hunger. The man whistled softly, then took a moment to think about this and sighed. I was almost one of them. I had a little pomegranate farm near Kandahar. Russians arrived and Mujahideen hid behind trees and in water ditches. He raised his hands and pointed them like a rifle. Ambushing. He lowered his hands. All the trees and ditches were destroyed. John responded, after that, what did you do? The man nodded at the list John held. Does it show beggars? It did not, but John thought he remembered. About 80 million in the world, I believe. I was one, said the man. He shook his head, seemed lost in thought. They sat in silence for a few minutes before he spoke again. I do not like beggaring. My child dies, so I raise poppies. Opium? Asked John. The man shrugged. No trees, no water. The only way to feed our families. John felt a lump in his throat, a depressing sense of sadness combined with guilt. We call raising opium poppies evil, yet many of our wealthiest people owe their fortunes to the drug trade, said John. The man's eyes met John's and seemed to penetrate his soul. You were a soldier, he stated, nodding his head to confirm the simple fact. Then, the man rose slowly to his feet and hobbled down the steps. John wanted him to stay, but he felt powerless to say anything. He managed to get to his feet and start after him. At the bottom of the steps, he was stopped by a sign. It included a picture of the building where he had been seated. At the top, it notified passersby that the sign had been erected by Heritage Trails of New York. It said, quote, the mausoleum of Halicarnassus piled on top of the bell tower of St. Mark's in Venice at the corner of Wall and Broad, that's the design concept behind 14 Wall Street. In its day, the world's tallest bank building, the 539-foot-high skyscraper originally housed the headquarters of Bankers Trust, one of the country's wealthiest financial institutions. Close quote. John stood there in awe and looked up at this building. Shortly after the turn of the last century, 14 Wall Street had played the role the World Trade Center would later assume. It had been the very symbol of power and economic domination. It had also housed Bankers Trust, one of the firms John had employed to finance his energy company. It was an essential part of his heritage. The heritage, as the old Afghan man so aptly put it, of a soldier. That John had ended up here this day, talking with the man, seemed an odd coincidence. Coincidence. The word stopped him. He thought about how reactions to coincidences mold people's lives. How should John react to this one? Continuing to walk, he scanned the heads in the crowd, but could not find a sign of the man. At the next building, there was an immense statue shrouded in blue plastic. An engraving on the building's stone face revealed that this was Federal Hall, 26 Wall Street, where on April 30th, 1789, George Washington had taken the oath of office as first president of the United States. This was the exact spot where the first man, given the responsibilities to safeguard life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people, was sworn in. So close to ground zero, so close to Wall Street. John went on around the block to Pine Street. There, he came face to face with the world headquarters of Chase, the bank David Rockefeller built, a bank seeded with oil money and harvested by men like John. This bank, an institution that served the economic hitmen and that was a master of promoting global empire, was in many ways the very symbol of the corporatocracy. John recalled reading that the World Trade Center was a project started by David Rockefeller in 1960, and that in recent years the complex had been considered an albatross. It had the reputation of being a financial misfit, unsuited to modern fiber optic and internet technologies, and burdened with an inefficient and costly elevator system. Those two towers once had been nicknamed David and Nelson. Now the albatross was gone. John kept walking, slowly, almost reluctantly. Despite the warmth of the afternoon, he felt a chill, and he realized that a strange anxiousness, a foreboding, had taken hold of him. John could not identify its source, and he tried to brush it off, picking up his pace. He eventually found himself once again looking at that smoldering hole, the twisted metal, that great scar in the earth. John leaned against a building that had escaped the destruction and stared into the pit. He tried to imagine people rushing out of the collapsing tower and the firefighters dashing in to help them. John tried to think about the people who had jumped and the desperation they felt, but none of these things came to him. Instead, he saw Osama bin Laden accepting money and weapons worth millions of dollars from a man employed by a consulting company under contract to the United States government. Then he saw himself sitting at a computer with a blank screen. John looked around, away from ground zero, at the New York streets that had avoided the fire and now were returning to normal. He wondered what the people who walked through streets today thought about all this, not simply about the destruction of the towers, but also about the ruined pomegranate farms and the 24,000 people who starved every single day. John wondered if they thought about such things at all, if they could tear themselves away from their jobs and gas-guzzling cars and their interest payments long enough to consider their own contribution to the world they were passing on to their children. John wondered what they knew about Afghanistan, not the Afghanistan on television, the one littered with U.S. military tents and tanks, but the old man's Afghanistan. He wondered what those 24,000 who die every day think. And then he saw himself again sitting before a blank computer screen. John forced his attention back to ground zero. At the moment, one thing was certain. His country was thinking about revenge, and it was focusing on countries like Afghanistan. But he was thinking about all the other places in the world where people hate U.S. companies, the U.S. military, U.S. policies, and the U.S. march toward a global empire. John wondered, what about Panama, Ecuador, Indonesia, Iran, Guatemala, most of Africa? John pushed himself off the wall he had been leaning against and started walking away. A short, swarthy man was waving a newspaper in the air and shouting in Spanish. John stopped. Venezuela on the brink of revolution, he yelled above the noise of the traffic, the honking horns, and the milling people. And we will continue Confessions of an Economic Hitman in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641 209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.